Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 192 of Unblocking Crypto. Al, we've had a good week here lately with Bitcoin. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, man. It has been a fun week.
So Bitcoin hit a couple of all-time highs here recently. I think the last one I saw was 126, 198. So the last all-time high previously was around just over 124,000. So the last week or so has been pretty freaking exciting. And it seems like a lot of that is due to what's happening in the ETFs. And if you look at the ETFs, I think last week they saw $3.24 billion in inflows, which ended up being close to $4.5 billion swing from the previous week with the outflows they had. So it's their second highest week ever. I think the last highest week was back in November of 2024. That was like 3.38. So it's not that far off. And even Monday of this week, I think the spot Bitcoins recorded their like almost $2 billion in a single day. So it's, I think, the highest single day total since like back in July 10th. So it's pretty exciting. And I think a lot of that is institutional investors, it seems like, trying to like catch up and do some of the risk off hedges with the government shutdown and all that kind of stuff. So pretty wild. So the other thing that I did see was BlackRock's iBit has now generated almost $245 million annually, which is more than any other BlackRock ETF, including all their products launched in the last 25 years. So we are just a smidgen away from their ETF also hitting $100 billion in assets, which if they cross that, it would be in around the 435 days area, where Vanguard's VOO was just over 2,000 days to do that. So it is insane how quickly all this stuff is happening.
Yeah, I have these as two of the top three things in my notes for this week too. iBit, BlackRock having the most revenue for them generated by the Bitcoin spot ETF. And it's not like they're the only one, right? So that's a lot of demand. It doesn't really matter where it's coming from. Yep, maybe some of it is people converting from spot Bitcoin that they hold in self-custody, converted over the ETF, so it's not really a net gain. That can't be true for the majority of this stuff. There's a reason why the ETFs opened at about $36,000 Bitcoin, and now we're at 120, in the 120s, and we're coming up on the two-year anniversary of that launch. So everybody's going to be in on this. You've got the S&P, you know, you talked about Bitcoin, but in a larger scale, the S&P is creating an index for like the top 50 crypto-based treasury companies and like crypto companies in general, Coinbase and things like that. So, you know, S&P is creating an index, right? That's not an ETF. And so if you look at like the legitimacy of Bitcoin, and even it's kind of carrying crypto along with it, it's getting pretty real. And you talked about hitting an all new high again. And so I think we've never talked about this, but whenever McDonald's releases the McRib, Bitcoin price goes up. And so, you know, you can't fade the McRib indicator. This is one of the dumb things that I think is funny about all the autistic people that like Bitcoin, is that they find these stupid things that correlate. And it's dumb because it keeps working. But it's just funny. That kind of stuff is like the stuff about Bitcoin that is funny to me. But, you know, the $100 billion worth of Bitcoin that's held by BlackRock, most of the people there would not want to invest if they heard an investment thesis around the timing of the McRib. But I think it's funny, and I think Bitcoin needs to keep some of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, shoot, it's not just Bitcoin. Ethereum had, I think, like $1.3 billion in inflows last week, right? So everything is going up, and everybody's trying to take some risk off with the government shutdown, however long that's going to last.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got a little indicator that they're going to soften and you know, keep bringing rates down, and that's a liquidity push. The I'm not sure if it was Trump or if it's from the Trump administration talking about a $1,000 or $2,000 tax rebate to all U.S. citizens based on the tariff revenues. So that liquidity is going to find a home. Some of it will buy goods, both like durable and non-durable goods. But a lot of people are going to buy Bitcoin or take a little gamble with it to try to grow it. And so that liquidity might be being front ran as well. So, you know, when Bitcoin can smell when they're going to print money. And so I think that's what's happening.
Yeah. And I mean, we talked a little about the S&P, and so Grayscale just announced that they're launching their first U.S. listed spot crypto exchange traded product that offers staking. So they have their Ethereum Trust ETF and their Ethereum Mini Trust ETF that both enable Ethereum staking. They have the Solana Trust, which hasn't been activated or released yet, but it's supposed to have staking capabilities ahead of its listing, which theoretically could come as soon as the government opens back up again. And then we've talked about all the stuff with the SEC changing their listing standards. And so I think Rex Shares and Osprey, they filed for like 21 ETFs last week, and including SWE and BCH, Hype, and all these other ones. Defiance had a filing for like 49 funds. Everything from like these 3x long and short leveraged exposure firms, and I mean, all related to Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, and a ton of other assets. So it's this just tidal wave of ETF products is about to be released onto U.S. investors, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, if you have all of these options and you have some liquidity coming into the market, like I think that they'll find each other.
Yeah, we'll see which ones survive, right? I mean, there's going to be a lot of options for sure. The U.S. Treasury was in the news too. They has issued some new guidance clarifying that unrealized gains on digital asset holdings will not be subject to the corporate alternative minimum tax, which you would think is mainly because of Strategy and a few other firms that have been pushing on this. And I think that helps them quite a bit. That CAMT was enacted back in 2022 and imposes a 15% minimum tax on corporations earning over $1 billion in annual income based on their financial statement income rather than taxable income. So it's kind of a crazy thing, but it's after, shoot, they've been, I think, lobbying on this since like May. Strategy and Coinbase being the two big ones have finally got it approved, I think, by the U.S. Treasury. So that's been good, and I think it helped out Strategy's overall stock price too, which we can talk about here in a little bit too.
Yeah, but not only that, I mean, you know, when these politicians write these bills, you know, they don't seem to think about like what is possible beyond what is currently existing, right? So when they wrote that, you had companies buying treasuries, holding cash, maybe some other assets, but I don't think you had anybody with $1 billion in unrealized gains. And so when you look at what Strategy's doing, you know, that bill or that act or whatever, that the tax implications of the CAMT make it impossible really to hold appreciating assets if you're an organization, which if anybody had an accounting degree was involved in creating that rule, they wouldn't have done it. They would have excluded unrealized gains because we don't tax unrealized gains because it's dumb. So this is having that in there in the first place is just it shows me they don't have technically minded people putting these things together because they aren't thinking about like one step in front of them. They're only thinking about what exists right now. And so it was a dumb rule. I'm glad that they changed it, but it's kind of like rewarding people for being dumb. Hey, good job fixing your mistake. Like pat on the back. You know what would have been better? Not having this mistake, right? It's like, I'm always constantly frustrated with working with people that always got rewarded for coming up with solutions to the problems that they should have prevented in the first place. And I feel like that's what they did here. So I'm not giving anybody credit, but good for corporations. And you know, it's good for Strategy, but it's good for anybody that wants to follow Strategy. You know, Bitmine is going to be in the same boat. They're going to have, I think they've got $13 billion in Ethereum right now. So they're going to have $1 billion in unrealized gains if they don't already. So that's, you know, good for them too.
Yeah, there are definitely a ton of people following in their footsteps. We'll talk about some of those companies in a little bit. So mentioned Coinbase. Coinbase just went after a national charter last week. So they're following in the long list of other cryptocurrency firms that are trying to get that OCC charter, which will really allow them to streamline oversight for new offerings and enable continued innovation to integrate digital assets into traditional finance. So they're definitely not the first company to seek a federal charter, and they're not going to be the last. But they also came out and said they have no intention of becoming a bank. They think there should be some clear rules, and the trust of our regulators and customers should enable Coinbase to innovate while ensuring proper oversight and security. So I know the other companies that have already tried to apply for the banking license was Paxos, BitGo, Ripple, and Circle so far. So yeah, an interesting list of companies for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Custodia Bank is still waiting for their charter. Mm-hmm. They've been after this for years. But now they are trying to be a bank, so maybe that's the holdup, is that they don't want kind of this new innovative blockchain-based innovation coming into the banking system. But you can just have some of these banking properties, I guess, is what they're going to allow. But, you know, they need to go for it, man, if you're Coinbase. I mean, Coinbase is trying to find ways to generate more revenue. They've got a headlock on custodying the institutional Bitcoin and crypto. And so they've got a lot of revenue coming in. Companies typically use that revenue to grow. So they'll find a way to do it.
Well, one of the other interesting things that Coinbase did is they just partnered with Samsung, and they are now going to give cryptocurrency access to more than 75 million Samsung Galaxy users in the US. And they're planning to extend that globally. But I think as of last week, the Samsung wallet users can access Coinbase One, which is their premium membership program, directly on their devices. So this is really helping to simplify the adoption curve for crypto by combining Samsung's mobile reach and Coinbase's trading and custody infrastructure. So that's pretty good. And I think at the same time that happened, Robinhood's app went down. All the whole AMD OpenAI announcement. So I think people are maybe a little frustrated with Robinhood. And now what Samsung and Coinbase can do is maybe bring some more people on there. And Coinbase is going to try to, I think, compete with Robinhood on some of the things they're doing now too.
A quick break from the podcast to talk about a little PDF I put together for everybody. I've been in crypto since about 2018 and made a lot of mistakes. The one thing I always get asked is, what would you do differently if you got in today? So what I've done is created a PDF that talks about the 10 mistakes that I've made and how not to make those mistakes ever again. If you're interested, you can check the link in the show notes or go to www.jasonexplainscrypto.com/10 and get access to that PDF. That's the number 10, not spelled out. Back to the podcast.
Yeah, I think we talked about South Korea. I mean, that's Samsung kind of taking the step out. But also, if you're Samsung and you're getting all these phones, you are competing against Apple. You need to find an edge, a competitive advantage. And I mean, you just saw the U.S. election and the edge it gave the Trump campaign versus the Kamala Harris campaign. So Samsung might be like, look, we can eat some market share if we adopt some blockchain and crypto, but Bitcoin stuff. So it makes sense to me. Also, what's the downside? It's another freaking app that people don't use. Like, guess what? I have to swipe like 6 times to get through all my apps on my phone. Like, it's not a big deal to have something on your phone that you're not using very much.
Speaking of an app that looks like it is being used quite a bit, so Walmart has what they call their OnePay app, which I should say Walmart. Walmart is the majority owned portion of this fintech venture. They are about to allow their customers to buy, sell, and hold Bitcoin directly on the mobile app. And I say Bitcoin, it's also Ethereum, but this is going to go mainstream to U.S. retail customers. Right now, their mobile app ranks number 5 among free finance apps in the Apple's App Store, which is ahead of Chase's, ahead of Robinhood's, ahead of Chime. So they also aren't just a single service, but they are a whole suite of financial tools, which includes the digital wallets for payment and rewards, a what they call one pay later or buy now, pay later option, and then some cards, which will feature both a debit card and rewards credit card for earning points. So Walmart has a pretty big net of who they're casting to, and this could kind of enable a lot of people to get to jump in and get started with crypto at a small service for sure.
Yeah. So when we worked and we had employees that were on the unbanked demographic, right? So when paying employees that don't have bank accounts and or bonusing or trying to get different things, that's when I learned how many people rely on Walmart to transfer money around. And it's a lot of people. And when you add it all up, I bet it's a pretty significant amount of money. And so I'd be curious to see kind of what this brings, but good, right? Like, let's just assume primarily this is lower income people because they're using Walmart's OnePay app rather than a banking app because maybe they don't qualify for a bank account. So if they can get a little piece of Bitcoin and they can see some appreciation and they can see some savings, I mean, that would be really good for them. You know, yeah, it's great when BlackRock, whatever it is, 0.25% on $100 billion. It's also great when like lower income people can double or triple their a little bit of savings and start to see the value of not spending money as soon as they get it. So I think that's good.
CME Group was also in the news. They're one of the leading U.S. derivatives exchanges. They have announced that they're going to begin offering 24/7 trading for cryptocurrency futures and options starting in early 2026, of course, pending a regulatory review. They are saying that they'll trade continuously on their Globex platform with only a 2-hour weekend maintenance period. And they will be executed during holidays and over weekends, or actually all the stuff that's on holidays or over weekends will carry over to the following business day's trade date. So I guess the question is, why is that important? If you look at some of the micro ether futures, they're up 472% year over year right now. So they're growing like crazy. Everybody wants access to it. We just talked about the ETFs and how much was happening from an inflow perspective there. This gives all these guys the ability to hedge and keep that going live pretty much 24/7. Minus a few days for holidays and a 2-hour period on the weekend.
Yeah. And not only that, coins price typically will gap up because Bitcoin's spot market is open 24/7 and CME is not. So it would create these gaps in the futures market where on the weekends or after market, the Bitcoin price would jump up. And when the CME market opened, there would be basically a zone in the price that didn't have any futures play. And I think it was 80% of the time, the Bitcoin price would come back and close that gap and let futures and create an opportunity for futures to bet, really, to invest in the futures in those pricing zones. So that was kind of one of the ways where, like, if price runs and there's a big futures gap, I'm like, it's probably going to come back to this gap. Like if it goes to 120, but there's a gap at 108, I'm like, it's probably coming back to 108. So I'm not going to think this thing's going to run to 150 and never come back. Well, that closes that in a 24-hour or a 24/7, you know, if they got a couple hours on the weekend and holidays, like the chances of a gap being created is way slimmer than it was. So, you know, if you look, Bitcoin's price is getting like tough. It doesn't follow all the same kind of stuff that it has followed in the past. I mean, as soon as the ETFs opened, I mean, we've just kind of climbed up with like maybe some 30% drops, but no 60, 50, 70, whatever. And so I think the CME going to 24/7 is going to be another angle for that where we just don't get to see kind of the same price action that we've seen. Same with like on-chain analysis. You know, the glass nodes and Willy Woos and all that used to be very predictive and pretty reliable. And, you know, especially if you zoomed out and you kind of took it as these long-term swing trades and not like daily, you know, fast trades, they were, you know, pretty reliable to the, you know, more than 55% of the time, which is kind of all you need to be successful. And all that's kind of gone away because there's so much off-chain impact, you know, macro stuff, but also the ETFs aren't on chain. So that's all kind of done around these wallets within Coinbase or whoever. So Fidelity. So you know, Bitcoin's changing. It's funny because Bitcoin isn't changing, but it's almost like the ETFs are layer two, and they have a big impact on how things move. And you just, you know, it makes it a little tougher to kind of predict the way things are going to go.
Yeah, no, so true. So let's talk about some of the treasury companies. Of course, start with Strategy. Bitcoin hits an all-time high, and Strategy doesn't have a new buy for the first time in a while. Although I think Saylor came out and hinted that they had about a $9 billion increase in the past week. So that's why they continue to hodl Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think they're at a point now where every $1,000 in Bitcoin movement is $1 billion on their balance sheet. I think that's where something close to where they are. And so, yeah, maybe it's 1,400. And so when Bitcoin goes from 108 to 120, it's a big deal for Strategy. And I mean, this move that Bitcoin made, Strategy's stock price was, up 8% in a day, and it was kind of moving and bounced back and things like that. But my expectation is that they sold into this rally because their price did not follow the Bitcoin price very well, and that they'll have a big buy next week. And it further cements my covered call strategy because their price escalation is dampened by selling into the ATM. But as long as you believe Bitcoin price is going to go up over time, holding Strategy is not a bad idea. So yeah, I like Strategy. I like Michael Saylor. I'm on board.
Number two treasury company is Bitmine. You talked about them earlier. They bought another 180,000 Ethereum worth just over 821 million. So they're up to 2.83 million Ethereum. They said their combined crypto and cash stash is now at like 13.4 billion. So second largest behind Strategy, but Strategy is still many multiples ahead of them.
So, I mean, I don't think there's enough interest or money to catch Strategy. And by the time there is enough, resources chasing this, I think the Bitcoin price is double, triple where it is now. So everything just keeps getting further and further away. And so, that's why I think these early players like Strive, Metaplanet, all these guys, even though it just kind of seems like they're kind of goofing when you compare it to Strategy and they're getting 5,000, 10,000 Bitcoin. Okay, well, if you double it, then in order to catch them, the next player is going to have to put in twice as much or raise twice as much capital as they did. That may be harder depending on interest rates and just kind of the looseness of money at the time. I mean, it's worth paying attention to these guys. Like, Nakamoto's under $1 a share. And that's, if you're under $1 a share for 30 days or more, then the NASDAQ will delist you. So I'm curious to see what they do to get their share price back up.
Yeah. No, it will be interesting. Wonder what their MNAV is right now. It's got to be low.
It's hard to tell because it's hard to tell if they've actually bought the Bitcoin or if they've allocated funds to buy the Bitcoin or if they have a promissory note or something to buy the Bitcoin. I think they did do a convertible note, but it's worth looking at, man. Like, Strategy was cheap at different points in time. I mean, when Bitcoin was at $20,000, I think Strategy's MNAV was like 0.8. So you're actually getting more Bitcoin for the dollar than you would if you just bought Bitcoin straight up. So there, there's a efficient market hypothesis where there are no deals in the stock market because everybody knows everything because information is so free. That's not true in Bitcoin because people don't understand it at all. And so I think that if you're looking for inefficiencies in the market that you can exploit right now, if you know Bitcoin stuff, that's your opportunity. Like, if you spent the last couple of years trying to figure out Bitcoin, then you want to capitalize on it, right? One, buy Bitcoin and do nothing else. Just let it roll. But if you got a little side, play money that you try to kind of trade just for fun, figure this part out. I mean, it's out there. And not only that, the you can sell options. I mean, the premiums on the volatility that Strategy had is the only reason that I'm doing what I'm doing. And I'm trading duplexes for Strategy stock because I can generate enough cash with the premiums. And not only that, when I have cash, instead of just buying the stock, I sell puts. So I make a premium. And then if I am assigned the shares, then I get them at the price that I agreed to anyway. So there's a lot of reasons to for people to buy or to play with these Bitcoin strategy companies. I think that the more people understand, the more they realize why they should do it. And the opportunity's there for sure. But yes, it's so much easier to buy Bitcoin and not have to even think about getting it, opening your phone or investing.
Yeah. So speaking of the digital asset companies that are kind of below their that one MNAV. So Avalanche, which we've been talking a lot about, there's a lot of activity with Avalanche. Their treasury company, Avalanche Treasury Company, AVAT, just aligned with the Avalanche Foundation, and they're going to merge with Mountain Lake Acquisition Corp, MLAC, on NASDAQ. The combination is going to be valued at more than like $675 million, which includes $460 million in treasury assets. They're expected to close in the first quarter of 26, of course, pending regulatory and shareholder approvals. Then they'll be listed on NASDAQ, and their strategy is including discounted token purchases and priority rights on the Avalanche Foundation sales to the U.S. Treasury companies, getting an entry point at 0.77x of the MNAV. And they're planning to expand their holdings to more than $1 billion in Avalanche and kind of position themselves as a key partner in that growing ecosystem there. So that will be interesting, and kind of what you're just talking about. If it's going to be less than one on the MNAV, then maybe it's an intriguing thing to look into if you have the belief that Avalanche will continue to grow on the institutional side like it has been here lately.
Right. I mean, like, if you, why buy Avalanche when you can buy Avalanche at a 70, like a 1.2 multiple, 1.25 multiple?
0.77, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But one over 0.77.
Yeah. Oh, like, yeah. You're right.
Yeah. So, you know, for every dollar that you buy in the Avalanche treasury, you're getting $1.20 in Avalanche or something like that.
Yeah. Injective was also in the news. We haven't really talked too much about them, but Pineapple Financial has launched a $100 million Injective digital asset treasury strategy. I think their initial purchase was about 678,000 Injective tokens valued at just under $9 million. So that's a new one. I think they're the first Injective company that's or Injective digital asset treasury strategy, but yeah, we'll see what happens with that one.
Yeah, I mean, it's that time to get, let's throw a bunch of stuff against the wall, see what sticks. And some of it's not, and some people are gonna lose money, but you know, it is time to try stuff.
And the last one I had from a treasury company perspective was CleanCore. They just added another 100 million Doge to its treasury, so they're just over 710 million Doge. Which is, they're saying they're sitting on $20 million in unrealized gains, but I think their stock still dropped like 7%. So still one of those, like, why are you shooting Doge? I'm not really sure. I think Doge kind of got hacked not too long ago and they're trying to figure out what to do there, but yeah, maybe it'll work for them.
Well, there's just a really big difference between putting Bitcoin on your balance sheet and putting Doge on your balance sheet. Like companies, the Norwegian pension fund isn't going to buy a Doge treasury company, right? But they'll put millions or tens of millions in on strategy. So, you know, there's a big difference in who's going to buy. You know, if you're putting meme stocks on your balance sheet, then you're looking for the meme stock money to come your way. When you put Bitcoin on your balance sheet, you're looking for any and all money. I mean, sovereign wealth funds have Bitcoin on their balance. It's not a lot, and it's not a lot of them, but it's more than zero. Yeah. And we know what happens when Bitcoin gets off of zero in a pool of money. It just starts swimming around and more money flows into it. So as soon as you open that valve onto a pool of funds, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so that's why I'm bullish on the big money flowing into Bitcoin.
Well, one of the things that we've been talking a lot about too is stablecoins, right? And how stablecoins are kind of enabling this flow into crypto in general. And Standard Charter just came out with a report that talked about how they're expecting all the emerging markets bank deposits are going to rush to stablecoins in the next 3 years. And they see it as probably a $1 trillion growth opportunity. I mean, if you look at stablecoins right now, it's like $176 billion. So to go from $176 billion to $1.1 or $1.2 trillion in the next 3 years is going to be pretty ridiculous. And I think Egypt, Pakistan, Colombia, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka are like one of the top ones that they expect that to happen. But Turkey, India, China, Brazil, South Africa, Kenya are also on that list of most likely to be involved with this transition too.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, you named Egypt, right? And I don't know a lot about the other countries and everything, but in Egypt, it's super difficult to get into U.S. dollars. They're very protective of their currency. And so you kind of have these black market U.S. dollar trades. If they adopt stablecoins and U.S.-backed stablecoins, even if they don't adopt U.S.-backed stablecoins, if they are convertible into U.S.-backed stablecoins, that would be huge for the people in that country to be able to get exposure to a currency that's more stable than their local currency. So I think that if you're into Bitcoin because you're trying to help people that are trapped in countries that have bad currency, I think that thesis bleeds over into stablecoins super easily. So I think it's good for people.
Yeah. And then speaking of stablecoins, so SoFi Technologies, which is, I think they're like a $30 billion publicly traded online bank. Most people know them for student loan refinancing and a little bit of stock trading. They're about ready to roll out their own stablecoin alongside some of the other crypto services now that they're coming back into the U.S. again. They described that the stablecoin would be, the primary use would be kind of a medium exchange between SoFi and its future crypto native partners. And it would allow faster, cheaper, more secure than the systems they have today in the traditional investing world. It would also be allowed for customers to make international fiat transfers via their SoFi Pay. And they have already enabled international fiat transfers in the Bitcoin Lightning Network in a partnership with Spark. So this is just going to be one more thing. And the interesting piece about SoFi is that they actually already hold a banking license from the OCC. So everybody else is really scrambling to try to get that, and they're ahead of them. So, and I think they're also saying that their long-term plan is tokenizing assets, right? And the way they'll start with that is some of their own loans. So just going back to the whole RWA story, they're getting involved in that. And yeah, it's looking pretty good for SoFi right now.
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about SoFi. We're not talking about crypto bank that's green spring out of the concrete, you know, that has maybe a shot, maybe not. We're talking about, I mean, I've never had student loans, and I'm aware of SoFi. So that's, you know, that's a substantial financial institution. So that stuff, that side of it matters to me. Well, you know, who's getting involved, and those companies have sway in Washington to get regulations bent around what they're trying to do. So that's why that to me is a bigger deal.
And then the last stuff that I had from the U.S. perspective was New York was in the news. Again, they seem to be one of the ones that it's hard to find positive news come out of New York lately. They are now proposing a bill to charge Bitcoin miners more for the energy they use. They are saying that since the arrival of crypto mining facilities, the electricity bills statewide have gone up $79 million annually for individuals and $165 million for small businesses. So they are proposing a law, I think it's S8518, that wants mining companies to pay depending on how much energy they consume. And then it's going to turn around, and whatever this they get is going to provide critical assistance to low to moderate income households across the state. So a lot to unpack there.
Well, you know, power industry is kind of my thing. New York's got high energy costs in general. They're set up that way, right? They're anti cheap energy. They're pro subsidized renewables that are intermittent, and you have to, in order to get the same 100 megawatts, you got to build a gigawatt, right? Whereas with other more reliable energy sources, you can build a gigawatt to get a gigawatt. Or you can build a gigawatt to get 800 megawatts. So their energy costs are going to be more. But energy costs are not just fuel costs, right? You've got the M&O, the maintenance and operation costs of energy facilities is based on labor rates and costs of materials and things like that. So your energy costs are going to go up if you're in a state where labor rates are through the roof, taxes are through the roof. You know, all of these things kind of contribute to that. I can't believe that there's a lot of miners in the New York, in the state of New York. There may be, right? I just, if you had to pick, right, if you were going to start a mining company, you would never pick New York or California.
Yeah, why would you go to the one of the most unfriendly crypto states in the U.S.?
But not only that, before you even start to think about the regulations and the political environment, the spreadsheet tells you that the number one thing you have to do is drive down your energy costs. And I can't imagine that there's any energy in New York that's inexpensive that touches the grid. If you told me, hey, there's some waterfalls that people are going to use to generate their own energy off grid, that I would believe you. But they wouldn't be able to regulate that, right? You're not, that power doesn't matter to the state. You're not selling it to anybody. Power rates are up dramatically across the United States because we destroyed the dollar during COVID, and we're still kind of seeing the impact of that. I mean, everything is more expensive, so everything is more expensive. I don't think we're going to get away from that. And it's hilarious to me to blame Bitcoin mining on that because, I mean, no one seems to be blaming AI on that or any of the other data centers. That doesn't seem to get nearly the rap that Bitcoin mining seems to get. So I think it's nonsense. It would take me zero time to figure out where I'm going to move if I was like clinging on to my mining operation in New York. I would be like, yep, all right, we're on, we're out. No problem. We can easily find cheap power somewhere else.
Well, I don't know how many stories we've gone over where it talks about how Bitcoin mining has actually saved a lot of the grid and made things better for everybody because you can turn it on and off with a light switch, whereas you can't do that with pretty much any other power source.
Exactly. I mean, if you're on the coast and you got wind power, and put a couple Bitcoin mining with it, because there's plenty of time when, I mean, the wind blows at night and you don't need as much power at night. So use that power to mine Bitcoin and subsidize the cost of your entire operation, man. Pay the loans with the Bitcoin mining operations instead of having to sell the power at a higher price to pay the loans. So whatever, man, I could talk about this for a long time. Just get out of New York. If you're in New York, just leave. So I can't figure out why you'd stay. If you're in New York City, you should double leave.
Yeah. Well, I think they're starting to go that way. So, all right, let's switch to something else. Sweden was in the news here recently too. They had two members of their parliament have called on the government to explore creating a national Bitcoin reserve, which is kind of the next European country to consider Bitcoin as part of their holdings. I think this was filed about a week ago by Swedish Democrats. They are asking the government to investigate it, and I think it'll be reviewed later in October at the next finance committee. But they think that by building a strategic Bitcoin reserve, Sweden is positioning itself for a potentially disruptive shift in the global financial infrastructure. Shoot, we've been talking about that for a while. So yeah, I guess they're waking up now to it too.
Yeah, I mean, how many times do we talk about something and then years later, serious people start picking up on it? I mean, we can move fast and we can do all that. You know, these guys are spending they're spending zero time thinking about Bitcoin. Honestly, if you're a politician, you're winning the fiat game in such a big way. Why pay attention to anything else? Just keep getting insider trades and keep building your fiat stack, and everything's great for you. And if anything other than that is, you can just laugh at it. You know, Bitcoin's just a joke. But if you're, again, man, if you're Sweden, I don't know where their GDP is going to rank them, you know, probably 50th country, something like that. I mean, I don't think they're a G20 company or a G20 country. So yeah, take a swing. Like, you're not putting your country at risk by adding 1-3% of your strategic reserve to Bitcoin. Nope. 1%. If it goes to zero, cool. Like, worth a shot. And if you're Sweden, I mean, think of the people that did 1% 6 years ago, right? Their 1%'s now 20. Like, that's a pretty good move. So maybe it's not 6 years from now that one becomes 20, but maybe it's 10, or maybe it's 12 years from now. I mean, if you're a country, what do you care if it's 10 years? Like, that's not that long in country terms. The United States is one of the youngest, right? We're 250 years old. Like, countries are old. You can think long term. You don't have to think about this. Like, everything doesn't have to be just setting up for the next election that's 2 years away. You could actually do something a little bit more long term. But It's harder to do that since 1971.
Well, so speaking of countries and some of the ones that are leading the global activity from a crypto perspective, India is in that number one spot. Their union minister just announced that they're going to introduce an RBI guaranteed digital currency at a government event in Doha. I think that happened the other day, but they're not banning unbacked cryptos, right? They're just going to continue to tax them very heavily to discourage use, but they are trying to say they're favoring regulated asset-backed tokens, and they are worried that in doing this, it could risk slowing private crypto innovation and bureaucratic delays. So we'll see what happens with all this. I mean, I guess good for India to try to start moving something forward, but their own kind of sounds like a CBDC is, I don't think, the right answer.
No, I don't think so either. And it still surprises me that we don't talk about India all the time, about all the good stuff that India is doing to advance themselves in like crypto and Bitcoin innovation. I mean, they have decent enough infrastructure. They're very technically savvy. So for them to just kind of be on the wrong side of this, it's weird to me.
Well, the other one, so number three on that list of global crypto activity is Vietnam. And Vietnam just made an announcement. Their deputy finance minister said that they're going to have a maximum of 5 licenses for a crypto exchange pilot program, which is interesting. They've received 0 formal applications yet, but they said they know companies are preparing systems and conducting preliminary discussions with officials. The problem that a lot of the industry experts say is the high capital requirements and regulatory uncertainty worry that this approach is really going to favor large financial institutions over some of the fintech innovators. So that because this entry bar is so high that most potential applicants can't clear it, and you now have this 5 license cap. So instead of having this sandbox, it's just really a closed compound, and kind of some of the big financial groups will do it, but you're not really going to have the innovators like you're having in the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame when you kind of almost get it right. Like, don't let the big guys come in and innovate, right? They're going to innovate, and even if their ideas aren't great, they've got enough money and energy to push bad ideas across the finish line. And like, I'd much rather have 20 small guys and one of their ideas be so good that they become a medium-sized guy. Like, that's how it's supposed to work. You don't, this is like centralized government, pushing ideas. Like, it sucks. Let the market make the ideas. The good ones will become successful. If you're a big player, bad ideas can make it all the way through because you just have that kind of network effect and you have those funds. So you're close. You're just really far off.
Thailand was in the news too. So there was this Portuguese guy, I think he was like 39 years old. He had a bunch of cryptocurrency and credit card fraud totaling $500 million off across multiple countries, Portugal, Europe, Philippines, Thailand. This Portuguese journalist discovered him at this Bangkok luxury mall. He apparently has been living in Thailand illegally since 2023. And he had managed to avoid his initial arrest warrant that was issued when he first entered the country and remained there because he didn't renew his visa or officially register his address. So, I mean, there's a lot of immigration stuff being talked about, and I'm sure this is one of the reasons why they talk about things like this, but I guess he's caught, and that's good, and can't get away with stealing $500 million of money from people.
Good. Yeah, you shouldn't get away with stealing from people. And I mean, honestly, 2023, it's only a couple of years. That's pretty decent to find somebody in Thailand.
Like, yeah.
Not too bad.
So the opposite of stealing money would be insuring it, right? There's a company called Meanwhile, which is a Bitcoin life insurance company. They just raised another $82 million in new funding to meet the surging global demand for Bitcoin-denominated life insurance. I think they do annuities and savings products too. But that means that their total funding for this year is now $122 million from, because they had raised about $40 million earlier. So that's pretty interesting. And I think I was telling a buddy of mine this before, is use Bitcoin as an insurance product, especially for like a 503C or the what's a college savings plan? 529. 529. Yeah. So it's, yeah, I'm intrigued to see where this goes. And it sounds like they're growing quite a bit with this type of insurance using Bitcoin.
Yeah. So this is life insurance, but I've definitely considered, you know, I've got these rental houses and my insurance is through the roof. Every time something happens, I never do an insurance claim because I don't want my premiums to go up. So I end up, it's only $2,000 to fix this hole in the roof that this tree limb punched a hole, and I'll just fix it for, you know, $2,000 and not have to see an increase in my premiums. I'm like, why the heck do I even pay for insurance? This is dumb. So I started running the numbers and then I got distracted and I need to get back into it. But instead of paying an insurance company, why aren't I just buying, like taking whatever those premiums are and buying Bitcoin with it? And then if I never have to use it, great. You know, all of the insurance game, it's a long-term game. I've been paying premiums on these things since 2016. If I was buying Bitcoin the whole time instead of these premiums, I wouldn't be worried about these fire. You know, I wouldn't be worried about a total housing collapse or the housing market collapse. I'd be like, great, let's get rid of these houses, buy more Bitcoin, just stop dealing with all this stuff. I mean, I think, you know, we talk about we're kind of ahead of the game on stuff. I do think that real estate people are, I'm seeing this a lot now. My algorithm is like the intersection of real estate and Bitcoin. So I am seeing people that are like me, but there's a lot of people that are houses that are getting out that they're not sure about the, you know, can rent stay as high as it is, you know, with the economy and inflation squeezing people out. What's going to happen in the housing market? If we're going to deport millions of people, what does that mean for housing supply? If the government gets involved and starts stimulating housing, the building of new housing, what does that do to the cost price of houses? You know, there's an unbelievable amount of crap that you need to think about. In addition to, I'm on my third painter that won't show up to paint this house. I'm trying to pay people to paint a house so I can sell the thing. I mean, this, I started in June. I'm on my third painter because it takes a week to get him up there to get a quote. And then it takes a little bit to iron out and kind of negotiate and settle on a price. And then I give him the go ahead. All right, you're on the schedule. It'll be 2 weeks. 2 weeks go by. It rained again another week. I mean, you know, you're 6 to 8 weeks before you realize, oh, this guy's never going to show up. I've done that twice in full, and I met a guy yesterday. So I'm on my third guy yesterday. I don't even have a price from him yet. So I might be 8 weeks away from finding out that I need a fourth guy to come paint this house so that I can sell the daggum thing. And then by then, it's going to be the middle of winter. It's not the best time to paint a house. So trust me, you don't have to deal with any of this crap when you have Bitcoin. You just sit on it, hold it. You don't have to do anything. Price goes up, price goes down, whatever. But like, oh crap, it's annoying. So to go, I'm bending this conversation away from insurance and into housing, but there's so many reasons to not get into real estate right now. Not the least of which is if you can get them repaired, it's wildly expensive and you lose months of your rental income. But the property taxes and insurance are going up faster than rent, and it just squeezes the returns out of real estate. And so if they squeeze the appreciation out of real estate by increasing supply or reducing rents because people can't afford to pay the rent, which rents rarely go down. But if they go flat and all of these other expenses keep going up, then it's the same principle, right? I mean, you're still, your return's getting squeezed. And so, you know, I'm into this. There's other people on X that are talking about it. And when these boomers die off, and their Gen X and millennial kids have this freaking property that needs repairs and work, and they're not used to doing it. In addition to working a job as hard as they can, having kids, busting their tail, they don't have time to take on another part-time job, getting these real estate investments to break even, produce revenue. They're going to dump these houses, man. They're going to buy Bitcoin. So to me, insurance is in trouble. For car insurance, you got automated driving that's going to reduce the number of accidents. House insurance, you got people like me, they're like, I'm done. This is dumb. I'm going to buy Bitcoin with it instead of paying you. And then if I need to, I'll cash out the Bitcoin or I'll find the funds elsewhere. So I think, yeah, life insurance is the same way, man. I wish I was buying Bitcoin instead of my life insurance premiums. You know, my kid's 13, so I've been paying premiums every year for 13 years. Man, I wish I would have bought Bitcoin instead of insurance, life insurance.
Yep. Right in there. Right with you there. So another thing that I was reading about MetaMask, most people are familiar with MetaMask. They are a Web3 wallet created by Consensys. They are about to roll out an on-chain rewards program in the next couple of weeks. This will yield referral rewards, and it'll have some MUSD incentives, which is their new stablecoin. They'll have some exclusive partner rewards, access to tokens, and more. I think they're saying they're going to distribute over $30 million in Linea token rewards. And Linea is their token on their Ethereum Layer 2 network that also Consensys did and launched back in September of this year, so about a month ago. They said the longtime MetaMask users will not be ignored. They'll get some special benefits, and the rewards will have meaningful connections with a future MetaMask token. So there's a lot of stuff going on. I'm intrigued to see what happens with this and where it goes and if they get blowback or if they actually do it the right way. But that's kind of exciting to see that MetaMask is going to have some good things coming for people that have been using their wallet for a long time.
Yeah, I feel like we've talked about MetaMask almost every week for a couple of months now. And that's a big deal because we might have gone a year without really talking about it before that. So, you know, yeah, good for them to kind of keep things fresh and moving, get back in the news. And it seems like they're in the position to be in the lead for, you know, Ethereum and kind of crypto wallets. So then they're doing what they need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading just a little bit about Consensys in general. They keep saying they're trying to build these token-powered economies that create positive sum relationships between users and builders, right? So Linea was the first one thing that they tried to do that with. MetaMask, of course, they're trying to do the same thing with. They have this, what they're calling their DIN, decentralized infrastructure project, done by Fura. So that's kind of intriguing that I'm hoping will be successful, but it's... at least they have the right mindset and they're not going the other way where they're trying to screw everybody like most of your big financial companies are these days.
Yeah, that's something. I mean, you know, maybe they'll screw them later once they become new financial companies. But yeah, I mean, if you're, you know, the good thing about being retail and a small player is you can be nimble and you can make moves and you can kind of outpace things and try to find some alpha, try to find some advantages. And you should do that. Like, it's your only advantage against bigger players, so you should use it.
So Kalshi's been in the news quite a bit here lately, too. I think they had, like, twice the volume of Polymarket here recently, and their president just came out, and so they're a prediction market, of course, U.S.-regulated, the only U.S.-regulated one right now. They just said they expect to be on every large crypto application and exchange in the next 12 months, according to their head of crypto, which is pretty interesting, and he thinks that would be kind of like a 10x unlock for them. What they believe is that prediction markets are the Trojan horse for people to enter crypto. So that would be really cool to see if that happens. And I mean, on top of that, Polymarket, which is kind of their biggest competitor, just received $2 billion in terms of investment from Intercontinental Exchange, which is the owner of the New York Stock Exchange, which means that Polymarket's valuation is $9 billion. So, and if Kalshi is having 2x the volume of Polymarket, that has some pretty good long-term projections for what Kalshi could do here in the future too. So these prediction markets are becoming really interesting.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, Kalshi's also got like some Trump family ties to it. If I remember, one of the Trump sons is involved somehow. So that's always a nice advantage to have a government edge. And so it's kind of like Tether getting into the United States. You got to kind of play the old school network game while you're also playing like the newest, most innovative game possible. Like, you know, it's tough for these guys to play both sides where you're rubbing elbows at, you know, $50,000 a plate dinners. And then you're also working in your garage at 100 miles an hour to build something, you know, even if the garage is 50 employees in an office building.
Yeah. You were talking about housing a second ago. I did also see Open Doors CEO put out a little bit of a social media hint. Someone had asked him whether Open Door would permit home buying with Bitcoin or crypto. And he responded that we will. We just need to prioritize it. So that would be a pretty big deal if all of a sudden Open Door, which is one of the largest online home buying places, would start allowing Bitcoin and crypto to be bought, used to buy homes.
Yeah, I think that would be, I think that'd be cool. I think you'd have a lot of people try to consider, it's just different, right? Pulling money out of your checking account is different than pulling money out of an investment, right? It's just, it's, it can be easier to justify. Like, man, you know what? I bought Bitcoin when it was at 10,000 and I can buy a house for four Bitcoin when I have $40,000 invested in it. Like, that's kind of an easier thing to let go of. So there's not that many people that have that kind of position, but there may be that many people that have that kind of a down payment instead of buying the house outright. So I think the more Bitcoin it kind of is infused as a medium of exchange, the better. I do think it's early for that sort of thing, but I support it.
One of the other things we've been talking a lot about is Hyperliquid and the perpetuals that it's doing. There's another company called Lighter that has just opened its public mainnet after about 8 months of private testing. They're positioning itself more as the Ethereum settled alternative to the current leaders, where they have the centralized style performance, but settlement finality anchored to Ethereum and fairness enforced by ZK proofs, right? So they're a little bit divergent on their fee side, right? So retail traders use the front end and pay no fees, while the API and high frequency traders are paying a majority of the fees. So the reason this is important, right, is perpetuals is still pretty new in the US, right? It's been big outside the US for a while, but the perpetual DEXs just topped $1 trillion in a month for the first time. And that was a 48% surge from August. So it is growing like crazy as the US now has access to the perpetuals side of trading. And now Lighter has a very intriguing pitch over the Hyperliquids and Asters and companies like that. So I'm really intrigued to see where this goes to.
I like the business model of, hey, we're gonna ride on the tails of these, you know, APIs and these larger traders who have an advantage over retail and over just small time guys, and we're gonna give the smaller guys a reduced fee. And we're gonna ding the bigger guys. A, they're using the system more. B, the system probably wouldn't be there if it was just based on the small traders. So might as well let those guys pay a little more freight, since you know the system is built for them. I kind of like that idea, especially as far as, like, you know, just getting more exposure for more people that are on the smaller side.
Yeah. Galaxy Digital was also in the news. They just launched Galaxy One, which is this consumer-focused financial platform. It's going to be led by Zach Prince, and I don't know if you remember his name, but he was one of the co-founders of BlockFi. So it's interesting. I think they're giving people a 4% APY cash account insured by Cross River Bank, and then the FDIC is insuring it for up to $250,000. It'll also give you crypto trading for Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, I think Paxos, Gold as well. So, yeah, I'm not sure how it will go, but I'm not sure that people are going to be super excited to see Zach Prince in there running it.
I will not be involved in that. So Zach Prince, one of the reasons why I put money in or put Bitcoin into BlockFi is he went on a podcast, long-form podcast, maybe Peter McCormick's podcast. Sounded great, man, and they had a big system. They used Fidelity as their fiduciary to custody their Bitcoin. And I mean, we talked about over collateralized loans, all the stuff that would create a safe-ish way to do what he was doing, providing yield on Bitcoin. Then, without saying anything to anybody, including Peter McCormick, changed all of the stuff, all the infrastructure of the business, put money in 3 years capital, took loans against other people's money, all of the things that made everybody else collapse. He did all that stuff, never talked about it at all. There was no disclosure about it at all. I griped to Peter McCormick about it on social media, and he was like, yeah, they didn't tell me any of that either. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's good. At least they didn't tell anybody that they were changing the way they were running their business and making it more, you know, they were increasing the risk for holding it. So luckily I pulled out all of my Bitcoin, almost all of my assets from them before they collapsed, but no thanks. And I think after Prince left, or got whatever after BlockFi was bankrupted. I feel like he went to like be a real estate agent or something like super ordinary and just got out of the entire system. So I'm like, no thanks. It doesn't sound like he's a bad guy. You know, and I know how business stuff goes where you start making decisions that you wouldn't normally make. Like, everybody's ethical when you're profitable. You know, when you start losing money is when you really get tested, and very few people pass that test. And he didn't. So it's fine, but it's not fine for my money.
Yeah, probably not the guy you want to put there, but oh well.
Yep.
So we've talked about Hive Mapper in the past, and that's a deep end project built on Solana. It is, you get this camera that you mount in your car, and then you get paid in, I think it's like honey or something like that, to based on the number of miles you drive. Well, they just raised about $32 million. In the past, you've had to buy this dash cam, and it was going to be just under $600, and then you get these tokens. Well, they just have launched this new subscription for their B dash cam. It's $19 a month, 24-month commitment. What's interesting about what Hive Mapper is doing is their map data, they're collecting it 5 to 6 times faster than these traditional companies like Google Maps and Apple Maps. So it is kind of intriguing. I've actually looked at possibly getting one of these and putting in my car because I do drive quite a bit for work. So it's something I'm considering, and I don't know. It might be something that I play around with here in the next month or two.
Yeah, back when I was driving all the time, you know, from Georgia to Texas to Wisconsin, that would be something I'd consider.
Yeah. And I think that, of course, they give you bonuses based on if you drive on roads that they don't really have a lot of map data for. So there's some advantages depending on where you're driving and all that kind of stuff, which is intriguing.
Yeah, well, based on what I've seen, my little town, Tesla doesn't have a whole lot of information on mine based on the full self-driving lack of success I've had around town. So maybe there's a premium for living in a small town.
Ondo Finance, which is one of the big RWA guys, they just completed their acquisition of Oasis Pro, which is a regulated digital asset broker-dealer and alternative trading system. This gives Ondo an SEC-registered broker-dealer, an ATS, and a transfer agent designation, which will make them compliant for tokenized securities within the U.S. That's a big deal. So I'm expecting that we're going to start to see a lot more announcements from Ondo and other companies using this Oasis Pro to help tokenize different assets in the U.S. for sure.
Yeah, I've seen some real world asset stuff popping up on my radar. So I imagine it's heating up. You know, if you're really paying attention to it, it's getting pretty exciting.
And then the last thing I saw was an announcement between Polygon and Alloy X. So Polygon, of course, is one of the layer twos on Ethereum. They are going to be the launch venue for a new tokenized money market fund that Alloy X has developed. Standard Chartered Bank is going to be the custodian and registrar. And then unlike conventional shares, these tokens are going to all be issued and transacted on Polygon's blockchain. So Standard Chartered will ensure off-chain asset custody and record keeping. And Alloy X is also going to be using Chainlink's proof of reserve. And then I think Navlinks, they'll use them to provide the real-time transparency into the assets backing the token. So that's kind of interesting. We're starting to see them all happen all on chain and all on, and this one is choosing Polygon to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's more things will be on chain. That's the way it's only going in one direction. It's a ratchet strap when it comes to the way this thing goes. And now, granted, we're only a couple of clicks in. It doesn't let go.
What else did I miss?
You missed some things that you'd have no chance of knowing. The one, me and a couple of guys started a small little batting cage indoor performance improvement facility for baseball and softball players. And so I'm kind of ramping up the software to do the reservations and create the app and do all these things. And so I was going through my onboarding process, talked to a guy, and I was having to look up, create a DUNS number while we were on the call. So we were kind of killing time and some dead time. And he was asking me, I don't know what he asked me about. Maybe, I don't know. Anyway, I ended up being like, yeah, you know, I do the podcast. And so, it was because we're getting the app launched into the App Store. And so I was like, yeah, you know, I touched on this. I haven't done it. He's like, oh, so tell me about the podcast. Told him about this. He's like, man, you know, I've had people talk to me about it here and there, but I've never really dug in. And I was like, So he was like, well, send me the podcast and we'll do it. So, you know, this is a guy that works for he's like a developer or a customer servicey kind of technical guy for a kind of innovative app creator, you know, I mean, just a tech guy, and he's not even into Bitcoin. And I'm like, man, early, like, you know, this guy should be all over it. And then he, you know, he's like, it's kind of been in his purview, but, or has been in his, whatever, it's been introduced to him, and he's never taken a couple of hours to figure it out. So that was kind of one of those, like, man, we're still early. And then the other thing is, I'm not a good podcaster because I went on a rant about real estate, and I didn't even mention the fact that I'm dealing with a house that I'm trying to improve the appliances. Well, I can call Lowe's or Home Depot and I can replace the appliances, and it only costs me about 3 months rent. Right. So like, that sucks. And so I got this 13-year-old kid who can help me move refrigerators and stuff now. And I'm like, yeah, we're going to just do this. And I need him to kind of learn how to work and, you know, see some value and explain, like, hey, you can either do the thing where you don't, you know, leave the house and you pay somebody else and you get brand new stuff, or yeah, you can pick up some, you know, used appliances from whoever on Facebook Marketplace that look good, that match what you want to do. And, you know, you can save $2,300 and the money that you want to spend. And so anyway, it was funny. I was like, this one was in a neighborhood that's a nice neighborhood, man. It's like one of the only neighborhoods I'd consider moving to. And so, you know, small town, right? So I'm talking to him. He's redoing the whole house. Carpet, appliances, everything. And so we had some mutual friends. One of he was a financial advisor. He worked at a firm where I know two of the guys. One of the guys is into Bitcoin and has been in it for a while. And so when he mentioned his name, I'm like, oh man, yeah, he's a Bitcoin guy. Like, you know, you ought to listen to him. And this guy, he was a young guy, and he automatically, he knows at least two of the Bitcoin people I know in town. And so he would jump right into, like, yeah, I mean, people ought to have 5-10% of their net worth in Bitcoin, and launched right into it. And I'm like, oh, well, yeah, there's the third financial advisor I know in town who's pro Bitcoin. So that's probably worth making a note. So the tech people that I'm talking to aren't into Bitcoin. The financial advisors that I talk to are into Bitcoin. Seems backwards, but, you know, the ETFs kind of changed things. Like, the slow, like, nerdy technical innovation adopters have been swamped by the finance bros that you know, number go up is the reason for adoption. So those are just two little pieces of me walking around and doing stuff over the last week that I bump into Bitcoin.
Yeah, and anytime the price goes up, people start to talk about it a little bit. It's still one of those things where I feel like it's not getting talked about nearly as much as everything else going on, because there's a lot of other crazy things going on. So it's exciting. I mean, that's the whole point of, I think, this conversation, is to make sure we're talking about all the big news that's happening. And man, we've had, what, 8 months now, I think, of like positive news for the most part, which is just amazing to see. And it is, unfortunately, kind of a slow burn, not this huge 3x overnight type of thing that I think everybody was hoping for.
Yeah, I mean, the last time I had a memorable conversation about Bitcoin with someone who is not into Bitcoin was at a Christmas party in last year. So, I mean, we've been at 100,000 or more the entire year, and no one's like, hey, talk to me about Bitcoin. I know you're into it. Let's grab lunch. You know, nothing, none of that. Just, it's just such a weird thing, man. I'd love to see, like, a psychologist kind of do a study on figuring out why some people are so resistant. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, we're definitely not going to fix that here, unfortunately. So,
I feel like Bitcoin people talk to people that are into Bitcoin, and then slowly people kind of that aren't into Bitcoin become, you know, more Bitcoin friendly. And then next thing you know, they're into it too. But it's like, to expand that threshold out to people that aren't into it, it's just a slow grind. Like, you kind of have to talk to the walls and talk to people that agree with you and preach to the choir until like somebody stumbles in the door to listen to you talk.
Exactly. Well, speaking of talking, we can shut up now and we'll talk again next week.
Sounds good, man.
All right. Thanks, Al.
Thank you, Jeff.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.